days when you guys started.
Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon and welcome to the Monday, May 23rd, 2016 informational hearing on the Joint Committee on Marijuana Legalization. It's great to see a lot of you after having a couple of months doing our own things. And today the purpose of our meeting is to check in on implementation by hearing from some agency representatives and some local jurisdiction representatives, as well as Senator Edwards on the health task force work, to hear how things are going. And I think you'll join me in thinking there's a lot going on. So we've got a lot to take care of in the next 2 hours. And I'm going to begin by inviting up to the dais, or to the witness stand, Jesse Sweet and Danica Hipschman from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Welcome. And you may go in any order, but please start by saying your name for the record. We're glad you could be here today.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Jesse Sweet with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and I have Danica Hipschman, who's been leading our licensing effort here with me. Rob Patridge and Steve Marks send their regards. They were unable to make it today. We're going to be running through what we're doing on our rulemaking and an update on our licensing implementation. In the fall of last year, we adopted approximately 80 pages of temporary rules to implement the 2015 legislation. This was primarily House Bill 3400 and Measure 91. We had an extensive public engagement process with a master RAC and many subcommittees, including over 100 total stakeholders and 38 total meetings. Staff is confident that we got the best set of temporary rules out of that process that we could. However, as we have begun our work with implementation, we have realized there are opportunities for refinement in those rules, which brings us to the permanent rulemaking process. On Wednesday of this week, we will have a public hearing on permanent rules to adopt the 2015 legislation. There will be a two-week public comment period. And then on June 2nd, we will begin expanded licensing activity based on the 2016 legislation. Following the public comment period on June 16th at the OLCC's regular commission meeting, we will adopt the permanent rules for the 2015 legislation, and we will adopt temporary rules for the 2016 legislation, which amend the newly adopted permanent rules. There is one piece of 2016 legislation which we will be handling separately. That is the medical canopy under Senate Bill 1511, Section 2. This is sometimes referred to as the bump-up canopy. Due to the complexity of the issues there, we felt it was more appropriate to just go straight into a permanent rulemaking process rather than have a temporary rule, which then changes and becomes a permanent rule. So that's what we'll be doing with the bump-up canopy. Key changes in the permanent rules, which will be adopted next month: reduced fees for micro-canopy growers. These will be $1,000 to $2,000, depending on size. The draft rules right now make the micro-canopy grower license identical, but for the fees. So same requirements for tracking and security and whatnot. We've streamlined our security rules. As our staff have been working through security waiver requests, we've realized that there are some items which are so frequently waived that they don't need to be in the rules at all. We're making those adjustments. We're also potentially revising our packaging rules. Additionally, we have looked at retail discount rules. To allow discounts and coupons, which were not allowed in our prior draft, but to continue to prohibit the bundling of products for tax evasion purposes, which this committee also took up in statute. Additionally, we are creating reduced fees for a laboratory license, which is only accredited to do sampling. Samples must be collected by an accredited licensed lab, but in order to allow market flexibility, we are proposing to have a sampling lab with a reduced fee if that is the only activity that the lab is engaging. Our temporary rules for the 2016 legislation, we will have revised application requirements. This will get rid of the 51% rule, which was in our temp rules. It will get rid of any reference to residency, and you will have a rule that is very similar to the rules for liquor license applications. We will also be taking on temp rules for inventory transfer for businesses transitioning from the medical system to the recreational system. This was a provision in 4014. And we will be addressing expanded access, otherwise known as co-location, for the retail, wholesale, and processor licenses. This was from Senate Bill 1511. In addition to those subjects, there will be many conforming amendments, some more mundane thing like expansion of the worker permits, Lux exemption, removal of redundant statutory language. And I'd like to talk a second about the medical canopy and what we'll be looking at in our permanent rulemaking there. The statute allowed OLCC growers to produce marijuana for medical purposes subject to certain conditions and limitations. The conditions were a contract with a patient or caregiver. The medical canopy does not count towards recreational canopy limits. And the excess may only be transferred to medical card holders, OHA processors, and OHA dispensaries. Within that basic framework, there are many questions that are left unanswered, and these are the questions we'll be addressing in our rulemaking process. Principally, what needs to be in the contract between the grower and the patient? Related to that, what happens when the contract terminates? How much medical canopy may a licensee produce? If we get an application that says, I want to grow 2,500 square feet of recreational canopy, and by the way, I have 500 patients that I would like to serve through my medical canopy, we need to make some choices about what we do with that application. And we'll make that clear in our rulemaking process. Additionally, how much usable marijuana may be transferred out of this canopy to individuals and to processors and dispensaries? And how does this bump up canopy or additional medical canopy interface with the existing Lux requirements? At a very high level, that's the summary of OLCC's current rulemaking process and activities. I'd be happy to take questions now, or if you like, we could go ahead with the licensing portion and take questions at the end.
Do I see anyone who has a burning question before the licensing portion? Yes, Representative Buckley.
I don't know how burning this. I just don't understand what a sampling lab is. Can you tell me what a sampling lab does?
Yes. Thank you, co-chairs, Representative Buckley. In order to collect a sample of usable marijuana or a marijuana item for the required testing, that sample has to be collected by a licensed laboratory. We're not going to allow growers and processors to do their own samples. We heard from people in the industry that was going to be a real burden, for example, for people in Southern Oregon if the labs are all located up in the valley. Mm-hmm. So a sampling lab is somebody who only does sampling, who's essentially acting as a courier. A courier is the wrong word because they're going to be accredited by OHA to do the proper sampling procedure and make sure that we have good results. But it's designed to allow a business whose business model is really to just go back and forth between the growers, the processors, and the brick-and-mortar lab locations.
Gotcha. Very good. Thank you.
Any other questions before we hear about licensing? Please proceed.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Danica Hipsman. I'm the Director of Licensing and Compliance for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I'm here to do an update on where we're at with marijuana licensing. The slide that you'll see here just kind of gives an overview of the total number of applications that we've received. It's been a very busy year so far. We've had applications streaming in since January 4th. These slides were prepared last week, so the numbers have changed just a little bit. Currently, we have a total of 974 completed submitted applications. 670 of those are producers, and of those, 297 are indoor producers, 375 are outdoor producers. And as we projected, throughout this year, we've started with the outdoor producer applicants, given that that group of applicants has kind of a defined season that they need to work in. At present, we have all outdoor producer applicants assigned to a license investigator and actively working through the process if they are received by the middle of April and they have the completed LUX. There's one piece of this slide that has changed, though, and that's the total number of licenses approved. The commission met last Friday. They're meeting on a weekly basis now to grant licenses, and so the total number of approved licenses is 26. And we have another 8 to 10 on deck for this coming Wednesday. And we've also had approximately 24 inspections happen around the state in the last week or scheduled for this week. So we expect those to be rolling out in the next couple weeks as well. These are the application stats that we have by county. We post these on our website daily and update them daily. As you can see, it breaks down the total licenses by license type. The highest numbers that we've had statewide for the producers are in Jackson, Clackamas, and Washington County, followed closely by Josephine, Lane, and Multnomah County. This is one area where the online licensing system has been incredibly beneficial because a lot of those areas, we have smaller regional offices, but we've been able to leverage our resources in other areas of the state so that we can just keep moving the applications and so no office gets bogged down by a particular number of applications that that office may have. This is our licensing timeline. It's pretty similar to what we've been projecting since late last year. One change, though, is we've kind of extended the timeline in which we anticipate processing producer applications from January through July. At this point, most of the outdoor producers have either been processed or they are getting ready to be completed, but we anticipate that it'll take probably through the end of July to wrap those up. We are getting far enough along in the process, though, that we do anticipate that we're going to start processing indoor production licenses and processor and wholesaler license applications within the next week or so, probably through August. And then moving on to processing retailer applications July through October. And throughout this process, we'll be working on the labs. Currently, we have 6 lab applications in the system. This is a graphic that we've used just to generally explain the life cycle of a license application. Once it's been submitted, the first step is obviously making sure that it has local government approval. As you may have seen from a prior slide, we still have roughly 250 applicants that have not completed that process, and so those applications essentially are on hold until they receive a LUX response from the local government. 43 of those are producers. Once we do get the local government approval, we move into the application review. This is probably the most intensive, most time-consuming part of the process. We ask the applicants for information on their business structure, how they're planning to comply with the security rules, and what their plans are for basically operating the business. It's a very document-intensive, time-intensive process for our staff to review everything and make sure that it's compliant with the rules. If anything comes out of that that would show that the applicant is not licensable or they can't meet the requirements, we propose denial. So far, we have actually not had to do that. Applicants have been pretty good about getting us the information they need or working with our staff to get them to the point where they could be licensable. Once they've completed the paper process, they would move on to the inspection. We've completed approximately 50 inspections statewide so far, and as I said, about another 24 last week and this week are scheduled. After the inspection takes place, if everything is compliant, we can go ahead and have the license issued. We have been finding that most applicants, by the time we get to the inspection, they are either completely compliant or with the security rules, or they have just minor corrections that they need to make. And I think that's a credit to our staff of really working with the applicants through the process to make sure they have everything in place. Having been doing this for about six months at this point, we have noticed a few things that are slowing it down a little bit. The first and foremost would be incomplete applications. This is a process that requires a lot of information. We need a lot of information to know what they're doing and who's doing it and what the general plans are. We've been working with the industry to create a lot of different forms that would help them guide them through the information that we want and need in order to issue a license. And we found that those that have taken the time to use those forms have moved through the process exponentially faster. So we're definitely encouraging people to use the forms that we've created. Another slowdown we've noticed is incomplete site construction. We've had a lot of applicants that wanted to get through the paper process, and then they're waiting on contractors to be able to complete whatever construction that they needed. And we've heard anecdotally in certain smaller areas of the state that there's been a lack of contractor resources, which has kind of slowed things down a little bit. Security compliance issues has been another issue, and this is another area when we've been really working with applicants in the industry, particularly for the outdoor growers, where that segment of the applicants really have unique situations that may not have access to electricity or internet capabilities in order to comply with some of the rules. So we've been really working with the industry to figure out ways that can help them get into business in those locations, but without really compromising the integrity of the security rules. Lack of testing labs is another major concern that we're seeing. Currently, we only have six applicants in our system. Only one of those, we're told, is actually in the process of receiving ORLAP accreditation. ORLAP has informed us that they have a number of additional applicants in their process, but those have not actually applied with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission yet. We're working with ORLAP to come up with kind of a joint informational session so we can bring in both of our sets of applicants and kind of walk them through that dual process so that that doesn't become a bottleneck for the development of this industry. And finally, just some limited staffing resources compared with the number of applications. Particularly for the growers, it's already far exceeded the original expectations. I believe it was originally estimated to have about 400, and we're well up closer to 700. So this is one where we've just kind of banded together as a team. It's going to be kind of an all-hands-on-deck approach. Even other compliance specialists, managers, directors, even myself, I gave myself a file load to process applications. We're just kind of all pitching in to get through the process and get it done. And finally, in addition to working through the licensing, we've been working on getting the CTS system up and running. This is the, you may have heard of it referred to as CTS or Franwell or Metric. It's all referring to the same thing. It's the seed to sale tracking system that's developed by the same contractor that develops Colorado systems. We're happy to report that it was delivered on time, it was delivered on budget, and it is working. We've already seen our new licensees put their plants into the system and watch them kind of move, and some are even moving into the flowering stage. So it seems to be a success, and we're looking forward to continue to work through the industry. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Danica, I'm just kind of curious, getting back to the previous slide that identified the lack of testing labs.
Yes.
And you've only had five applications so far, and one has successfully passed. Are you doing anything to kind of reach out more for other industry or agencies or organizations to show their interest into this?
Yes, Representative Olson, we have been working with industry members. We've been actually proactively reaching out to labs. Us and ORLAP have been working together to kind of cross-exchange information so that we can see those applicants that they have in their accreditation process. We can reach out to them and say, hey, you know, you need to also be applying in our system, and then vice versa. And we are looking to plan kind of a joint informational session within the next couple of weeks with ORLAP so that we can actually physically bring all of those parties in and really explain to them the need to be able to be marching both processes at the same time.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Question? Yes, please.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. Jesse, I think this would be for you, and I'm sorry, I think I missed something that you mentioned a while ago, and that was the release of the 2016, the release of the rules based on the 2016 legislation. What did you say about when those are to be released?
So, co-chairs, Representative Wilson, the temporary rules for the 2016 legislation will be considered by our commission on June the 16th. At this point, we have not released a draft to the public on those rules. We did have our Rules Advisory Committee consider them in April, but they have been evolving since that time. So my goal personally is to end their evolution within the next week or two, and then put them out on the website so that there's an opportunity for the rules to be seen by the larger public before they're considered by the commission. Because it's a temporary rule process rather than a permanent rule process, we don't have the normal public hearing and public comment period that's required by the APA. That will take place when we go into the permanent rulemaking process later in the year.
Follow-up, please. So then it would be safe to say if the vote on the rules is coming up on the 16th, then when do you expect to have the temps out there posted for the general public to see?
I do not have a fixed date. I hope to have that as soon as possible.
Okay, but we can rest assured that it'll be out there before the vote comes up.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. If I could ask one more question, too. And I think, Jesse, this is probably for you. Some members of the wine industry have asked about the security fencing, the 8-foot-high wood fencing. Looks like a bunch of Fort Apaches out there, you know. The question the wine industry has is, how could they help to get that requirement dispensed with and simply go to something like wire fencing that is not so austere appearing to those who are engaged in wine tourism in the Applegate and the Williams Valleys? A lot of the people that are engaged in that industry hear from their customers. I mean, what is this and why do you have it? So I guess the question is, if this were to go away, how would it go away? What's required?
Thank you, Representative Wilson. I would like to note that we have a public hearing on these proposed permanent rules on Wednesday of this week, May 25th. And following the public hearing, there will be a 2-week public comment period on which the commission will receive written comment. Also, as it regards to fencing in particular, there are options for producers who do not want to install the 8-foot-tall fencing. We have a fairly open-ended security waiver process, and this goal can be met in a number of ways, and Danica can probably speak more specifically to that than I can.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. We have heard a lot about that from our applicants. Obviously, I think there is a lot of confusion in particularly the way the rule was written. It made it sound like it was more of a mandatory as opposed to an 8-foot fence. It's just one way in which you could meet the obscurity rules that we set. And so we've taken a hard look at that. We've actually developed some internal guidelines that's actually not requiring much fencing at all. Basically, what we've said that is if you're 150 feet off of a public roadway, you're almost de facto obscure enough that you don't need to have any sort of solid fencing. You still would need to do something to prevent public access, but a wire fencing, deer fencing, or even sometimes natural terrain can meet that. We've had some applicants that are far enough back that you couldn't even see it with binoculars. We've deemed it as long as the rest of the security is in place, there's really not it's not necessary to put up the expense of having a fence like that. So we've listened to the industry, and I think the guidelines we've developed are really helping a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just following up on that, is the purpose of the fence for aesthetics or is it for security?
Senator Beyer, it's really both. We took some language from the House bill that we needed to prevent public access and public view or obscure from public view. So it was a little bit of both.
This is on ag land?
On any land, sir.
That seems, I think I agree with where you're going. I think that's ridiculous, particularly in agricultural areas. If we don't do that for any other crop, I don't know why we do it for this.
Okay, good thing for that. Did you want to respond to that last comment?
Oh, sure. No, and we've certainly heard that from the industry, and it's something, you know, that's where we've been trying to develop these guidelines that would actually reduce it significantly, the need, while we have the rule in place. But I don't doubt that that's an issue that we'll be considering during this rulemaking because we've heard a lot of comments on it already.
Okay. I have two questions for you. One, and it can go to whomever the appropriate answer. I've heard some concern about ambiguity in terms of immature plants and the legislature's decision to remove the limit on immature non-flowering plants and how that is being implemented. I think it might be an OHA implementation, but I think it's relevant to OLCC as you do inspections and are helping authorize transitions from the OHA regulatory system to the OLCC system. Is there an ambiguity that you are encountering? Could you describe that for the committee so we're all aware of what the issue is?
Yes. Thank you, Co-Chair Leininger. As it relates to the recreational canopy, there is no ambiguity. The statute's very clear that immature plants do not count towards a recreational canopy. The ambiguity, I think, comes up into play when we're talking about medical growers. The recent changes to the statutes eliminated any reference to immature plants in the medical plant grower limits. So I'll get out of my depth if I start talking about the OMMP program too much, but I will mention how that affects the OLCC. When we're talking about transitioning medical growers to become OLCC growers, part of that transition is an allowance to transfer medical inventory and on a one-time basis, kind of wave your magic wand and turn that into recreational inventory. As it relates to immature plants, this is challenging because part of that transition requires a release from a patient. So if a patient has a possessory interest in an immature plant and the medical grower is allowed to have an unlimited number of immature plants, it becomes difficult for the agencies to determine how those immature plants may be properly released by the patients who hold a possessory interest. So that's the piece that OLCC has been struggling with as far as the larger issues that may be more appropriate for OHA to respond to.
Okay. Well, I wanted to say my own, and I think you folks are doing a great job. I think the agencies are all doing a really great effort to implement legislation that we've all been working on together for the last 2 years, and it's hard. And I really am grateful for your hard work. My perception of the legislative intent behind removing reference to plant count limits was that we wanted to have immature plants not count toward plant count limits. So to the extent there are going to be some ambiguities that we have to work through as we move forward, but that's my sense of what we were trying to get at as the Measure 91 committee as we were working through that. If anyone else has different perspective on that, please feel free to weigh in. Okay, so a second issue that has come to my attention is has to do with hemp and cannabis. And I got word recently that folks who are looking to be licensed both to do hemp production and cannabis, or registered for hemp production and licensed for cannabis production, have encountered a decision or a possible rule that draft rule that you can't do both on the same location, even if you're making provision for non-cross-contamination. Could you speak to that? And again, I would just offer that it wasn't my perception that we were trying to, I think the legislative intent, there was not a legislative intent that I'm aware of to prohibit those two kinds of things from happening in the same location if adequate protections are made so that there's not cross-contamination, but could you describe what's happening?
Thank you, Co-Chair Leininger. Our current draft rules do contain the prohibition which you described, and the rationale behind that prohibition is not cross-contamination. It is really rooted in compliance and prevention of diversion. When we all started thinking about hemp, we were thinking about crops which were produced for seed and for fiber. What we found is that many people who are interested in hemp are cultivating this plant in virtually the identically to the way that recreational and medicinal marijuana are cultivated. So you have a situation where you could have a field of plants which are all cultivated identically and all appear to the naked eye to be identical, and you won't know which one of those plants is legally marijuana and which one is legally hemp until you get a lab result. So the proposed rule, which has not been adopted yet, it's a draft, was implemented to help us just regulate efficiently. It's a very difficult position for a regulator to have a field of plants which all look the same, some of which you have authority to regulate, some of which you do not, some of which are subject to seed-to-sale tracking, some of which are not. and you don't know the difference until you get the lab results. So that was the thinking behind the draft rule, the proposed rule.
Does anyone have any additional questions or comments for the panel? Yes, sir, Senator Przanski.
Well, Jesse, you said this rule is temporary rule is going to be voted on when?
It will be voted on June 16th.
June 16th?
Yes.
And have you received comment back? I mean, to the point of what the co-chair has brought forward, it just seems that there should be some means of allowing for those who want to have cannabis, which is no longer considered, I guess I want to say, marijuana, because there's little to no THC in the plant, as to why you would say that they couldn't be grown in plots. They got to be identified where they're being grown, and it seems like they still have to have the testing that's appropriate to determine whether it is actually industrial hemp based on the level of THC.
Senator Przanski, this is the first feedback I've heard on this proposed rule. It's not been adopted yet, so I'll be taking this feedback back to our commissioners for their consideration.
You can have another work group. May I follow up?
Please do.
Is there going to be another work group or follow up as to where maybe other people want to give comment? Can direct it to?
Certainly. This could be considered during the public comment period. And actually, I believe I misspoke. This proposed change would be in the permanent rules rather than the temporary rules. Mm-hmm. So it would be considered in the public comment period. And if there are any concerned citizens, I would encourage them to take advantage of that opportunity.
Thank you.
Great. All right. Well, I don't see any other questions, so thank you so much for your work, and we really appreciate it. Our next presentation is from the Oregon Health Authority, and we'll have Andre Orso, who's the section manager of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, come forward, please. And as an added bonus.
I'm going to bring up the document for the list, if I can.
Welcome. We have possibly Rosa Klein also presenting, possibly just bringing up a document. Either way, we welcome you. Mr. Orso, if you could state your name for the record, we look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, Andre Uso, Section Manager for the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. By me.
Please.
So what I brought up here is a timeline from a pretty much a 10,000-foot level of our implementation of not only 2016 new legislation, but then the leftover implementation from HB 3400. And then I'll give some brief overviews of specific implementations of those provisions and then some statistics related to our card program and our facility regulation. So currently what's going on right now is we are into public comment period for our permanent rules on labeling, concentration limits, serving size, and testing. That began in earnest Thursday, May 19th, and will extend through June 3rd till 5 p.m. We are scheduled to be at four locations across the state to accept oral testimony. Then, of course, the agency always welcomes written testimony until June 3rd. The implementation date for those permanent rules is going to be June 28th, and then effective date for most of those provisions, of course, is going to be October 1st to allow for implementation, transition over into the OLCC licensing system, and then testing of products as we move forward into 2017. So some of those rules include include housekeeping provisions related to 2016 legislation that would change the permanent rules that went into effect March 1st from HB 3400. So those rules would also be included in that public comment period. And then, of course, the ORLAP laboratory accreditation rules are also included in that public comment period. OHA recently announced that beginning June 2nd would be the implementation for the expansion of early retail sales of limited marijuana products, including edibles, extracts and then topicals. Those rules are currently filed with the Secretary of State as of Friday, and they are available on our website. They are temporary rules, so they did not go through the process of public comment as permanent rules do, and they will be effective June 2nd. And then, of course, as I mentioned, October 1st is really the compliance date for some of these rules. The compliance date for labeling concentration limits for usable marijuana and products to be tested, and then, of course, dispensary transfers, and then also in coordination compliance with OLCC's packaging rules, and then dispensaries being licensed by ODA as far as food handling and kitchen licenses. So some highlights of implementation and actions that the agency is conducting right now is we are beginning our inventory tracking and reporting. That will begin, I think, June 1st is the first month that we expect facilities, growers, to start reporting those numbers to the agency with a deadline of July 10th. It's always the 10th of the for the previous month's reporting. We are scheduled to do training statewide, I think 7 different locations between now and the middle of June to provide some training, some overview, some presentations for growers how to register for the system, how to report. We have strategically placed those trainings across the state where growers are most concentrated. So I think we have 3 or 4 trainings in Southern Oregon. We have a couple on the coast. And then, of course, the larger cities, Eugene, Bend, and Portland. Some specific highlights from 2016 legislation that we are implementing: the issuance of a card receipt upon receipt of a complete application. That is going into effect relatively soon. So I would say the beginning of June, people can expect to see those receipts when they apply for a card. The notice of, on stay on plant limits for the transition over from the medical system over to OLCC, and then bringing patients and inventory with those applicants. That should also be implemented sometime early June. And then, of course, veteran fees being reduced to $20 for all veterans that provide proof of service has already been implemented with the card program. So any veteran that does apply today would be subject to a reduced $20 fee. I think what's not provided on the screen for you is are some statistics from the program as of March. So card application volume, we've seen a 4.5% increase in card applications in the 12-month period between April 2015 and March 2016. Application processing time for the 12-month period is averaging 32 days for the past 12 months. So that is not statutory compliant on average for the past 12 months. However, as of January 2016, it has been below the 30-day statutory limit. And it has been as low as 21 days in February. We are seeing a creep up in that application review time because we are hitting our busy season when most renewals are done in late spring and early summer. But staff have been working diligently to make sure that applications are reviewed in a timely manner, in addition to being able to answer questions about all these rule changes that might affect our patients, our growers, and our dispensary owners. And that's certainly reflected in our card call volume to our OMMP program. In March, we received over 7,800 calls, which is a 27% increase. In the last 12-month period. That is due to probably a lot of changes in legislation, a lot of rule changes that have been implemented in March, and then again new implementation that will go into effect in June. So people are curious, people are calling and asking questions, and we are handling those to the best of our ability. Dispensary applications in the 12-month period from April 2015 to March 2016, we have had almost 700 applications for dispensaries. In the month of March, 79 applications were received, which is 36% more than on average for that time last year. And most of these are renewal applications, so dispensaries are renewing this year, and we anticipate that they will continue to do so through the end of the early start period, which would be December 31st. So we have seen a slight downtick in new applications, but renewals, of course, have been increasing steadily. And then, of course, processing site applications, which is something new to the program. We began accepting those applications April 1st. Those have been reviewed. I think we've received about 180 applications. We've listed 68 of those as being submitted as complete, and those are listed on our website. That means we've done an initial review. They've met the initial criteria for a complete application, and we've provided their information on the website so dispensaries may accept products for them, and they may be exempt from some criminal liability. We'll actually do full review and inspections of those facilities beginning in June. So that's basically the highlights of our implementation program from HB 3400 to all of the legislation that was passed this year. So I would like to open up for questions, and I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee members have.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What are you seeing in terms of new applications for medical cards?
Madam Co-Chair, we are seeing an increase. We're continuing to see an increase. We have no doubt that we'll have that see that increase for the rest of the year.
And what are you attributing that to?
Madam Kutcher, I wish I could have a good answer for you. Any answers that I could provide at this place would be statistical speculation. We would like to do an analysis into why we're seeing higher increases in card applications. My best guess would be based upon availability and access to higher concentration products and more possession, the ability for patients to possess more marijuana than a regular member of the public.
And Madam Chair, to follow up, are you keeping statistics on how many of those are full applications versus low-income or veteran applications?
Yes, we do keep track of the number of reduced fee applications versus non-reduced fee applications. We're seeing about over 50%, I think, of our applications qualify for some sort of reduced fee.
50%?
Over 50% qualify for some sort of reduced fee, whether it's Social Security benefits, veteran benefits, or I think SNAP or OHP. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the dispensary applications and renewals, do you have any sense of how many standalone dispensaries are going to be operating within the next year and how many have merged to merge with recreational?
Thank you, Representative Buckley. We did a survey back in the early spring where we sent out survey materials to our registered dispensaries. We had a pretty good response rate, around 40% of the existing registered dispensaries. Of those, 80 to 90% indicated that they would be transitioning over to the recreational side. So if we have about 440 currently registered medical dispensaries in the program. If we were left between 10 and 20%, we're looking at maybe 40 to 60 that would be just committed to the medical program going forward.
Thanks.
Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you. We're just following up on the dispensary applications. We've had some constituents asking about the length of time it's taken for being processed. If one was turned in the first week of March, how long is it anticipated? And it's a new application, it's not a renewal. Is it going to take for that to get through the system?
Thank you, Senator Brzezinski. It could take anywhere from 90 to 120 days. And we have been struggling with eliminating a backlog from the summer and fall of 2015. We've pretty much cleared that backlog as of the spring. So now we are dealing with new applications and renewals as they come in. It's a first-come, first-served basis. Getting at the back of the line, 90 to 120 days. That may also depend on the applicant themselves providing additional information after they submit their initial application. They do have a 60-day period and to get the additional criteria into the agency. If they can't, they can request an extension of another 60 days before the agency can actually come out and do a readiness inspection of the facility.
But if there's no problem in the sense that they've got everything in and there's been told nothing needs to be added and they've got acceptance and approval from the county, just straight processing is taking 90 to 120 days?
I would say on the 90-day half, it would probably take about 3 months for them to be completely registered and ready to go.
All right. And if I can follow up, Co-Chair Burdick asked about some of the reasons why some people may be going into the medical. You gave some speculation. Mm-hmm. It seems to me this is annotated. You have not done the research at this point as to why people may be seeing an uptick.
We do have some descriptive statistics on age groups, conditions, but those are just descriptive statistics. That would require some statistical analysis, maybe some additional surveys of patients to get some specific reasons why they're coming into the program. But we'd be prepared to do that sort of analysis into the summer, into the fall, to really uncover why we're seeing an increase in patient applications.
I'm wondering if you've heard of people coming into the program because now it's legit and that they feel that they have the ability to actually reach out, and maybe based on common information, education that's come out, that people are finding relief like CBD ointments and mixtures of lotions with THC. I'm just trying to figure out if because that's some of the stuff I'm hearing, is that people now feel that they can actually access stuff they can't currently access, and they've heard through other people, anecdotally, of course, that it actually is having an effect on their ability to live a daily life without pain.
Thank you, Senator Brzezinski. I would say that theory is probably not far off base. We are aware that the federal government has taken a lighter stance towards medical marijuana and the states that regulate medical marijuana. We know that scientific information related to the benefits of marijuana is becoming more robust and available on almost a daily basis. So I would say that there is a lot of credence to the legitimacy of medical marijuana and its use in alleviating qualifying conditions and treating those conditions. And I would suspect as we go further into 2016 that evidence will only get better and more robust and probably allow people to and their physicians to make the judgment that that's an appropriate course of treatment for them.
Lastly, on the cost, it seems like this is one of the things that's in the mix. I've heard from people in law enforcement, they think, well, maybe people are going in to getting the medical card because they're going to save on not paying a state tax. I mean, the reality from the testimony we heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, unless someone qualifies for a reduced card, it's $200-something for the card itself, another $200 to $300 per year for the patient to requalify. So they're already putting out somewhere in the range of $400 to $500, maybe $600. That seems like if you were going and buying at a 25% tax rate, you probably still would be coming out ahead paying the tax than getting a medical card. Wouldn't you see that might need to be also viewed to see whether or not it makes economic sense for people to be supposedly going to the medical system to avoid a tax?
Yes, thank you, Senator Brzezinski. I would agree on that. That's an analysis that we need to do. I think that from OHAs, our fees are $200 per patient unless they qualify for some sort of reduced fee. And then, of course, they're during early retail, there is the 25% tax. That would be based on the amount of cannabis that a patient would buy versus the amount that they could buy as a public consumer. So if they're going and buying larger amounts of cannabis, then, of course, the fee would be offset by the lack of taxes that they would pay on that cannabis that they're purchasing with their card, as opposed to going in through a retail store, paying the 25% tax. And if they were purchasing a high enough amount of cannabis, then maybe the tax would be worth taking rather than paying the fee. We have hired an economist recently. We will be asking that person to do some analysis on the costs to patients as they are in the program. Those are going to be interesting questions that we're looking to answer going forward.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you. Any other questions at this time? Yes, please.
Yeah, just a follow-up. Because they are allowed to have much higher limits and much stronger products, the potential exists for people to abuse that system. Have you given any thought to better ways to enforce that medical marijuana cardholders are not abusing the system by selling it to others for a profit? In other words, kind of encouraging their own little black market.
Sure. Thank you, Co-Chair Burdick. There are regulatory and enforcement mechanisms for people that do abuse the card system for OHA to come in, investigate those claims and complaints, and if possible go through an administrative process where we can suspend or revoke the patient's card that would be abusing the system. I think that's a short-term answer. I think that's not going to fix any long-term abuse of the system. Going forward, I think that OHA needs to work with the medical community and getting some sorts of standards or community standards of care established so that physicians can have the appropriate conversations with their patients on what appropriate use for their particular condition is. And I think once we start legitimizing more of the medical use of marijuana, then we will probably see a decrease in the abuse of the system.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being here, and we appreciate the hard work that OHA is doing. You have a huge amount on your plate from this legislation that we've all crafted together, and we're grateful for your diligence.
Thank you, Co-Chairs, members of the committee.
Next, we are going to get an update from the Department of Revenue, and I'd like to call forward, please, Deanna Mack, Legislative Liaison, Jolene Swint, Processing Center Section Manager, pardon me, and also we're going to get an update from the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and Lauren Henderson, who's the Assistant Director of ODA, will provide that, and please welcome to the front. All right. And we will begin, it looks like, perhaps with the Department of Agriculture.
Yes.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Leininger. For the record, Lauren Henderson. I'm the assistant director. I thought it would be better if I went first. I know my colleagues from Revenue have a lot to chat about, so I will be very brief so and give them more time. Just a couple of things. I think, as I've mentioned here before, we felt a need to contact our state partners in Colorado and Washington on what they were also doing, primarily around pesticides, and I'm here to report that was a good decision by us. I think the three states have learned a tremendous amount from each other and have also been able to connect with EPA on some of the challenges related to having states with legal cannabis production and how that intersects with the federal rules around pesticides. Our group has been so popular that California and Alaska have asked to join us, and so the next meeting will be with those states as well. So we're adding members to that group, which I think is a very good thing. We have lots to learn from each other. Secondly, and I don't recall this happening in this way, we were the co-conveners of what I'm going to call boots on the ground with the regulatory staff or the investigators from our department, as well as the health authority, or OSHA and OLCC, and the state police, to actually get 50 or 60 of the staff that are actually going to be on the ground to network with each other so they get to know each other as they see each other out working with this important industry. But it was really more about understanding what each other's programs were, so there wasn't this confusion. I anticipate it went so well. We will have that probably as an annual thing so that the staff can be I think it's really important when they see their colleagues out that they know who they are, and if they have a question, they're not afraid to pick up the phone. And so that went very, very well. The next thing is I think our agency is about to see how we're going to do with this as we get the licensing, and you saw the data up there from the two agencies on the processes they're going through. I think particularly around the edibles, there's a very short timeline between June and what is October to not be a backlog in that process as well, because if they're producing edibles, they will need a food safety license. And so we're going to have to internally figure out how do we meet that demand. I think it's a surge demand, frankly. I think once we're all caught up and get past maybe October or November, I think it'll be something that we can talk about maintaining. But I really anticipated it just off the top of my head there. I saw about 300 establishments that could need something from us, and so we're going to really have to work hard not to be a delay in that, because we certainly don't want to be. I think it'll take us a couple of weeks if someone's really ready to go and they've kind of thought through what their establishment needs to get them processed and out, but more to come on that. The last thing I'll mention, because it did come up, was hemp. I know several of you are interested in hemp. Some of you have heard this before, but we're in our second year of production. It's growing. I think the last count last week, and I'm sure this is old, we had about 42 growers. That's up from 11 or 13 last year. We also have about 1,100 acres registered so far. That doesn't mean that all 1,100 are probably going to get planted, but that's what we have registered. So far, it's going, I'd say, better than last year. I think that was a big help to some of the changes that were put in place legislatively to help people along. And so I'll be glad to provide an update on that anytime you all want that.
Great. And we have several questions for you, so we're going to go ahead and have questions to you first. Rep. Wilson had one, and then we'll go to Senator Cruz and Senator Farioli, please.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Lauren, thank you again for your help on the industrial hemp side of things. Want to ask you to get together with me at some time appropriate here to talk about this issue that we've heard today about the lack of ability to co-locate industrial hemp and cannabis here. I think there's got to be some middle ground on that subject, and that's not what we're here to talk about at the moment, but I would like to get together with you and kind of tap your expertise and your thoughts on that, because as I say, I think there certainly is some middle ground here. I think we're running the wrong direction, and so I'd appreciate talking to you. Thank you.
I would love to support that work. Sounds great. Senator Cruz?
Where are the majority of the 1,100 acres?
This is off the top of my head, but it's pretty well spread out. I think I remember. I'm not going to speculate. I looked at that chart really quickly, and I can get that to you. We actually have it broke out. I do remember it's pretty spread out across the entire state. Yeah.
Great. Do you have a follow-up?
No. I'm just curious as to where the industry is growing. That's all.
Absolutely. Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This hemp is legal for production and the distribution of products in all 50 states, if I'm apprehending that correctly. And when, if a person does a online search for CBD oil, you can find that it's marketed in a dozen different potencies in across a wide spectrum of retailers through the internet. But it's being sold as a pharmaceutical product. So maybe this is a question that needs to be bounced between OHA and Department of Ag. Department of Ag regulates industrial hemp, but industrial hemp can be used to produce CBD oil. And CBD oil is sold for a variety of uses, but what we've learned is that it's got a pharmaceutical application. Is there a connection between OHA and Department of Ag to look at who should be thinking about the idea that industrial hemp producers may be selling a pharmaceutical product? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Excellent. Do we have additional questions for Mr. Henderson?
Madam Chair, that was not a rhetorical question. I'm waiting for my answer.
Yeah. Please, yeah, thank you. That's great. I got distracted by something. I want to flag for folks before we move into the answer to that good question and then go to Representative Buckley's question that we have Senator Edwards has come in. And so after we're done with you, Mr. Henderson, I'm going to ask Senator Edwards to come up and give his presentation, and then we'll go to Department of Revenue because I know he needs to get to a meeting that he's chairing. So. Okay, thank you. So please go ahead and respond to that.
Chair Leininger and Senator Farioli, that's a very good question, and I have to tell you, we've talked about that issue a lot. Right now, the products that are coming from hemp that are going into human consumption, you all made some changes to that for the testing so that it would be treated on a level playing field. It is true that there are products that can be sold today legally across lotion. I think we have some in our bathroom. My wife just loves it. So we're continuing to have those discussions about what is it and what is it not? I can tell you that the sky's the limit when it comes to hemp products. It's just amazing what I've learned about what you can do with hemp products. So if you don't mind, I'm going to leave that as a standing question because I don't have all the answers. We are talking about where those lines are, but you all made some changes in this last time, and Senator Brzezinski's nodding his head because he was very helpful with that, to make sure that there wasn't this back door for at least on the parts on the human consumption side that they were tested equally.
Madam Chair, it is a question of product safety and efficacy, but I think there's an opportunity for us to have a discussion about CBD from hemp in context of what our medical marijuana users seek, which is CBD from cannabis, and whether or not it's medically identical, whether or not its chemical composition or effect is the same. I mean, I just think it's a really interesting conundrum that what can only be purchased in Oregon by a medical marijuana cardholder at a dispensary under relatively tightly controlled circumstances as a controlled substance can also be delivered by a drone from Amazon Prime to your front door. This is a little bit incongruous from my perspective, and I think it needs some conversation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Buck.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Yeah, just as the Senator was talking, I was looking at several websites that that have the products. It's quite, it's all over the place. Lauren, the only question I had was the boots on the ground. You listed off a number of agencies. I didn't catch them all. Could you just go through what those agencies were again?
Chair Leininger and Representative Buckley, sure. It was the Department of Ag, Oregon Health Authority, Oregon OSHA, Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and the Oregon State Police staff.
And I guess my follow-up question would be, are there plans to also talk to DEQ and also Fish and Wildlife in regards to the impacts of pesticides and their impacts on wildlife and on water?
We have had conversations with DEQ, and I think we'll have more of those. And we actually talked about adding two more, which is DEQ staff and revenue, into the next conversations.
The more the merrier. Thank you.
Excellent.
Chair Leininger, if I could to respond to Representative Wilson real quickly here. Yes, we'll have, following OLCC's League on the Commission on the Hemp, we'll certainly stay engaged with that discussion for you.
Great. Well, thank you, Mr. Henderson and the Department of Agriculture, for your great work and diligence on this issue. And with that, you may be excused from testifying, and I'm going to invite Senator and Department of Revenue folks, if you don't mind staying there. You may sit down if you want to, but if it's just as easy for you to stay, you're welcome to stay. Your choice. Senator Edwards, welcome. We are excited to hear an update on the Health Research Task Force, the name of which I think I may have misstated, but it's important and exciting, the work that you're doing, and we look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Chris Edwards, State Senator from Eugene, and I will be as brief as possible. You should have a copy of the task force report. The report is fairly, it is dense in that there's not a whole lot of extra fluff. I mean, everything that is in the report is relevant to the its relevant background and contextual information that really leads us to our conclusions. I'm not going to go page by page through the report. I am going to touch on the high points and get right to the recommendations of the report. The task force came out of Senate Bill 844 from last session. You'll recall there was a legislative effort to try to figure out, okay, what do we do if we want to encourage the research, whether it be for therapeutic medical use of cannabis products or the development of pharmaceuticals, the public health research and plant research. So if one wants to do research in the state of Oregon, what we really need to first understand what the what the federal framework is, what the state framework is, and what we would need to do as a state to move forward with that. I was fortunate enough to be appointed to the task force along with Representative Wilson, so I invite you to chime in at any time, Representative, and I don't know if authors of the report are here in the room today or not, and I, in fact, was not able, because of legislative conflicts, I was not able to make the very last meeting where we finalized all the reports, but I have had a chance to go through it and provide some background information and context. So the report, the task force started out with the process of looking at what types of research has been done already to date, and with respect to cannabis use, and specifically from a medical and therapeutic standpoint. Most of the research is observational research, that is not clinical trial type research, which is on human subjects. This has all been a learning process for me. I'd heard of clinical trials prior to this. I didn't know that's, and somebody could tell me if I'm wrong, if anybody's else is in the room that knows better, but my understanding is clinical research and human subject could be used interchangeably. So any type of research that happens on human subjects, clinical research, that is governed by federal law. And so in cannabis, the supply has to come from a NIDA facility, which is National Institute of Drug Addiction. That facility is located in Mississippi. It's a contract between NIDA and University of Mississippi. There's only one facility. As a side note, people that have conducted research and are interested in conducting research have shared with the task force that most of the cannabis varieties have THC levels, I believe it was said, up to 5%-ish, and they feel that there's limited utility in doing a lot of research with cannabis that is not representative of the general marketplace. Certainly from a public health aspect, if the recreational market regularly sees THC levels of 12, 15, 20, 25, even as high as 30%, doing research on 5% THC cannabis has a limited utility. So that's a side note. The material for human subject research has to come from a NIDA facility in order to get the cannabis. There has to be a DEA license in place. In order to get the DEA license, there has to be FDA approval of the study. In order to get FDA approval, Institutional Review Board has to oversee and approve the process. So there's a lot of, and it's appropriate. I mean, it's appropriate that on human subject type clinical research, there is a lot of controls in place. Having said that, it is anecdotally, it was shared with us that this can be like a couple year process to getting a study up and approved. So that's up on the clinical side. Then observational research, of course, is much less rigorous. You don't have to, because you're not supplying the cannabis. The researcher is not supplying the cannabis. They don't have to have NIDA approved cannabis, and many of the other steps are much looser. So I have a whole matrix. I won't go through the whole matrix under which circumstances which approval would be necessary. Suffice it to say that there is a regulatory framework in place federally, and if it is human subject, or if it's federally funded, or if it's an institution that receives federal funds, such as a university or a hospital, then those channels have to be followed. State of California is also, State of California and Colorado both have research programs. State of California's is through, is housed at UCSD, and it is the sole research path for state-funded research in the state of California. Colorado has a little bit different model in that they put out grants. So there are a couple of other places doing this type of research. Neither of them have a steady funding source, and Oregon does have the opportunity, I think, to with the right structure in place, and that's recommendation number one of the task force. If we put the right structure in place and a steady funding stream, I think Oregon really does have the opportunity to kind of move to the forefront in this area of research. So recommendation number one is to create an institute, a quasi-public institute, Oregon Cannabis Research Institute, with a governing body that's appointed by the governor, a list of, you know, shalls and shall nots regarding the mission, and then the legislature should consider funding that partly with revenues from the program. So that's recommendation number one, and I won't go through all the lists of the things that are in the report that institute should do, but they're on pages 22, 23, and 24 of the report. Recommendation number two is that we, from the task force, is that we heard from a number of professionals, and there were a number of professionals on the task force, a lot of PhDs and really certified smart people, and they said there's really for professionals in Oregon that are interested in conducting cannabis research, there's some hesitation and there's some gray area, and they would like clarification from their licensing boards that it is okay to conduct this type of research. So there's 3 points on recommendation number two that all center around getting clarification from their licensing boards about their position on cannabis research and the appropriateness of doing such research in their profession. So those are the two main recommendations. And to be honest, I haven't had a chance to talk with other task force members about pursuing a federal grow site. And I believe that was not included in the report for a reason, although, to be honest, Madam Chair, I don't know why. It seems to me as though we should pursue that for the state of Oregon, but it's not one of the recommendations of the report. Okay. So with that, that is as fast as I could possibly go through what I thought was relevant from the report.
Great.
And I'd be happy
to
take questions.
I'd be just a cautionary note. I'd be very careful about becoming a federally registered grow site, because the feds would put so many strings attached to it that it might make it no better than what goes on in Mississippi. So we might want to explore the options of Colorado and California and leave the feds clear out of this. Mm-hmm. Just a thought.
Senator Farrelly.
I'm sure 25 states have some form of legalization. But when you start asking folks about their hesitancy about getting engaged in research, I think the report points out, and anecdotally they'll tell you, licensing boards are not ambiguous about whether or not they'll jerk your license. If you're a physician, they might. If you're a research chemist, they might. If you're working for a university doing research, the admonition is if you get engaged in cannabis research, you jeopardize all federal funding for all research programs in the institution. So the number of downsides to engaging in research is clearly engineered to be an impediment to research. So the question isn't should we figure out what the right mechanism to go through the procedural requirements to get to a place where you can do research on a product that isn't even in the market anymore? I mean, the capacity has far surpassed the stuff that's available for testing through federal channels. I think the answer is to go back to the decision makers in Washington, D.C., and say, if 25 states have adopted some sort of legalization policy, where are we going to be in 10 years? And wouldn't you want to have the research trajectory put us in a place where the answers that we're going to need in 10 years are available in 10 years? The only way you get there is to start removing obstacles to research today. So I think we have to accept the recommendations of the committee because that's the state of the landscape today, but not overlook the fact that the real problem is there's so many built-in impediments to research that research institutions, researchers, chemists, physicians, medical facilities are disincentivized from even considering that. And that's a public policy thing that needs to be changed on a macro scale.
Thank you. All right. I appreciate so much your work on this, Senator Edwards, and your testimony today. Do we have any other questions for Senator Edwards before we thank him for coming to talk to us? All right, well then, thank you so much. And thank you also to the good people of the Department of Revenue who've been patiently waiting here on camera for the last little bit. We're pleased to hear your update, and please begin in either order by stating your name for the record and then letting us know what we should be thinking about.
For the record, I'm Deanna Mack. I'm with the Department of Revenue, and I brought Jolene Swint with me today to be able to answer any of your more specific questions about our banking processes. And I also have in the room our program manager, John Galvin, for any other questions that I am not able to answer. But hopefully I will be able to answer them all, I'm hoping. Cross my fingers. So I'm going to start out mostly around the depositing schedule for the early start. As you know, we've required dispensaries to deposit their tax payments monthly. The return for that first quarter was due on May 2nd, so we're still receiving them. The first day of sales was January 4th, and the first date or the due date for the January payments to be made either in person or have them be postmarked was February 29th. Same thing for the February payments. They needed to be made by March 31st. And the March payments needed to be made by May 2nd, so postmark or made in person. Just to give you kind of a sense of the timing, some of the, as is normal with all of our tax programs, there's a timing issue between when a return is filed and when payments are made. So you'll see in our financial statements, our first month reporting, we didn't actually follow our normal financial statements because we wanted to show you what was really coming in for the month of January deposits that came in through March 4th. Normally we would go through the end of the month, and as you can see, we have now gone through the end of the month, although April 29th for the third month deposits, we have $3.75 million, which is, I believe, a new number for you folks. That's through April 29th, and that brings our first quarter financial statement to $10.5 million. Those are monthly deposits that are remitted net of the administrative fee, and of course, we don't know what the actual tax or sales were until those returns are filed, and so that's why these are preliminary numbers. We're processing the tax returns as they're coming in, and we'll know more. We expect to have some sort of a reconciliation by the end of June so that we can have some actual numbers. Right now, paper returns, so they have to file by paper. That's the only option, is what we told you would probably happen when with the early start. It's all we could get up and running. But we will have before part of the long term through the retailer stores, they will be able to file online. We're in the middle of a core system replacement project at the department. Our return processing systems are being replaced, and they placed the marijuana tax program into rollout 3, which should go live sometime in December. I don't think the date is set yet, but of this year. So retailers will have their first due dates for that fourth quarter, which is when we're expecting OLCC to have retail stores licensed. Those will be in October sometime, so there should be a first quarter return due sometime in January of 2017 for retailers. But the dispensaries, the early sales through dispensaries that go through the end of this year will continue to file on paper through the end of this year. So you know that there's a difference. We don't expect that there is going to be any issue with them filing, the retailers filing online, because the seed to sale tracking system is going to be online and they're going to be aligned. We're hearing that that'll be manageable, but for retailers. Senate Bill 1511 authorized additional taxable products. As I think one of the other, I think it might have been Andre mentioned, the edibles, the topicals, and the receptacles. And sales are going to start, we're hearing that that's going to be their most anticipated day, June 2nd, of sales since the program started. So we will be making sure that our tax returns are updated. So it's a mid-quarter start, but it will we'll have some the paper returns updated by the middle part of June. So the due date for those quarterly returns will still be August 1st. It's the last day of the month, falls on a weekend. So, but that date remains unchanged. As you know, you have set in statute what programs the distributions will go to. We're hearing some questions about whether local governments that opt out are eligible for distributions. And I believe with the changes in this last year, there has to be a number of licensees. It's based on the number of licensees in the jurisdiction. So if there is no licensee, either effectively or because they've opted out, then there would be no distributions to that local government, for clarification. Also, we're getting a lot of questions about when we're going to start making distributions to local governments. First and foremost, you guys have required that the liquor fund be paid back first. And we're currently working with the OLCC to figure out when they're going to start billing us for that money. The loan repayment payoff is required to be done before September 30th of 2017. We're doing what we can to make that happen earlier. But the liquor fund loan can continue all the way through the end of June 30th of 2017. So we're expecting that first reconciliation of the administrative costs, the liquor fund, and then the remaining distributions will happen sometime after July 1st of 2017. And thereafter, there will be quarterly distributions, and that's all outlined in the statutes. As you know, the banking issues, large percentage of these businesses are remitting their payments in cash. The payment types, the payment range that we've received so far, range for all payment types, whether they have an account, a bank account or not, range from $10 to $90,000. And because of the per payment, because of the high level of cash, we are requiring that cash payments be made in our Salem office.
You know what, I think Senator Ferrioli has a question.
Madam yes. Chair, I can wait till she's finished.
Okay. Because we expect 60 to 70% of the proceeds to be remitted in cash, we created a cash transaction unit, and they are able to manage the volume efficiently, and it increases our taxpayer and our employee safety and security. That's been one of the primary concerns for the agency in that regard. So far, we have 337 businesses registered as recreational marijuana sellers, and these folks are required to schedule appointments in our Salem office. They've been very cooperative about that. Very few people have complained about having to travel to Salem monthly, and they schedule their appointments throughout the month at their convenience before the due date for the tax. Just wanted to let you know that as you probably have already figured out that the deposits in our cash transactions unit are about 300% higher than we initially expected based on the revenue forecasting. Mm-hmm. So tomorrow we're going to be going to the e-board asking for some additional positions to help manage that, maintain the dual controls, that are in line with banking standards, that kind of stuff, and ensure safety and security. It's been a little bit more than we expected, in particular on the safety and security side. So we want to just to alert you that there will be some additional costs we'll be requesting tomorrow. We also have been busy with administrative rulemaking. With the first two we adopted were temporary rules relating to due dates for payments and registration requirements for retailers. We had actually held a public hearing this morning for the permanent rulemaking. We're following up with the two permanent ones from those temporary ones, and then we have other five more rules that are in line with our withholding tax program. As this tax is a tax collected by the business, but it is imposed upon the consumer, so it's a trust fund tax, much like the withholding tax is, where your tax is collected at the source payment from your wages and then remitted by your employer to the department. So many of the rules and the statutes that you developed are based on that program, as are these rules. I did want to mention the public hearing was this morning, and public comment period is open until the end of today, 5 p.m. if you want to submit comments. We did have a couple people submit some comments. So we have some temporary rules that we are proposing. This one has to do with the receipts. As I just mentioned, that the tax is a tax on the consumer collected by the retailer. The statute allows for the taxpayer, or the consumer actually, to claim a refund of tax if they believe that it's overpaid. They first need to go to the retailer, and then if they can't get resolution from the retailer, then they come to the department. Except that because of the basic anonymity of this program, we don't know who the customers are. So for us to be able to show that they had any sort of tax paid, we would need them to have a receipt that shows the tax that they paid and was remitted. So this rule is requiring for the early sales, and this will end up being a permanent rule as well, breakdown of the types of tax that's being collected, whether it's a state tax, a local tax, the total amount, and a unique identifier on the receipt, and then also a statement to the effect of receipt required for refund, especially because this program is not in the seed to sale tracking system right now. It's even more important, and that's why we have the June 2nd date, because we need to make sure that those receipts are given as soon as there's additional products available to be sold. So those are out for public comment as well. They're not, I think Jesse indicated earlier that those aren't required to go out for public comment because they're temporary rules, but we have sent them out to affected folks, and we are hearing just anecdotally that there's some concern about the ability to get that done by by June 2nd, but we're being assured by some of the vendors that provide their receipting systems that they shouldn't have a problem with that. So that's what we're hearing, at least anecdotally. We are coming up. We are working with the OHA to figure out the medical cardholders exemption. We've got an administrative rule coming for that as well. And we are working on, we haven't been approached by any financial institutions yet. However, House Bill 4094 allowed us to share information about these retailers, about these dispensaries with financial institutions to show that they're in compliance with tax laws. We expect that there will be some in the future, so we're ramping up for that. We have, as you probably are aware, been approached by the League of Oregon Cities and the Oregon Association of Counties about the local tax administration. You amended our statute that allows us to provide those services to local governments to include the marijuana tax this last session. We have a draft agreement that they've proposed to us that we're looking through now to get that up and running in the near future. And with that, I just wanted to put in the record a kind of a quick cheat sheet of who knows what about what, so you know who to call. This is in one of our documents. And with that, if you have any questions, hopefully we'll be able to answer them for you.
Great. Senator Farioli, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm fascinated by the idea that you've got remittances that are not in cash. What form are those remittances taking? Don't tell me product.
Yes, Chair, Co-Chair, Senator Farioli. We get payments by check. We get payments by money orders and cash. Those are primarily, is there any other way?
I find the irony delicious, Madam Chair. These are clearly proceeds from production of marijuana products. Is that so?
Madam Chair and Senator Farrelly, yes, that's correct. One of the things that I do know that I'm hearing, that we're hearing from the banks, is that as they're identifying that these people have those types of businesses, they are putting them on notice for closure of their accounts. So we anticipate that those are going to increase over time as the banking issue that still continues. We have some customers that come in and tell us, hey, look, I'm on my third account closure, and it's going to be on any time. So that you know, we do expect that percentage to increase.
Follow up?
Yes,
Chair.
Please.
The purpose for us allowing you to share information was to demonstrate creditworthiness. And instead, the information's essentially putting the financial institutions on notice that they have to terminate. Madam Chair, I hope this goes further into the irony. So if there is a excess marijuana tax paid, how is the refund made to the remitter?
Madam Chair and Senator Farrelly, that is something that was handled in the very first version of, I think it was in Senate Bill or House Bill 2041. If a person, to address potential laundering issues, we will not issue a refund check to anyone that's greater than $1,000. If they deposit $200,000 and they only needed to deposit $20,000, the remaining $180,000 will roll over to future tax liability.
So, Madam Chair, under $1,000, you'll cut a check.
That is correct, because that accounts for transpositions and slides. It's the rule of nine.
Okay.
Maybe a math error.
And Madam Chair, is that check negotiable at any financial institution?
Madam Chair and Senator Farrelly, yes, it is. It's a
Department
of Revenue.
So it's not
check.
A matter of whether or not we're laundering. It's just the amount. Okay, and then, Madam Chair, final question.
Yes, please.
The unique identifier that creates a tracking mechanism so the state could determine if a purchaser was overtaxed.
Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, the unique identifier on the receipt is for our audit purposes so that we can look at their receipts and see. It'll be unique to that business, not unique in the whole program, unique to that business, so that when we examine, if we examine the return against their actual sales receipts, that we'll know whether there was anything omitted or zapped, per se.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
So the identifier is unique to the business, but don't you actually have to know whether or not the individual making the purchase had or did not have a medical marijuana card?
Madam Chair and Senator Farrelly, yes, we do have, we are working on administrative rules to know whether they're exempt from that or not. We envision a system very much like what Washington does when you take your Oregon driver's license up there to be exempt from the sales tax. They write it down on a piece of paper, and then we'll have a record of that in the audit to be able to tell the difference, and then the accounting for it on the tax return itself.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, I don't know that you have an audit trail unless you've got a unique identifier that identifies the purchaser. And so I would just suggest to you that we've so far avoided creating any situation like a driver's license scanner or keeping of unique identifier records. I thought the intention was not to create a marijuana user registry. So the question I have is, how can you create a tracking mechanism that may give you the retailer ID number without also knowing whether the purchaser has a medical card or does not?
Madam Chair, so you're saying because the tax would be zero on the receipt, and there would be a receipt there. The receipt itself is generic. It just has the name of the business and the normal. In fact, I think it's on the slide. Let me go back up. I do believe it also requires the name of the business. If the person wouldn't be requesting a refund of the tax if there was no tax on the receipt. So one of the things when we're doing the audit, we're looking at we probably wouldn't be looking at the receipt for that purpose. That's for people who need refunds. What we need the numeric numbering for is for the audit when we're looking at the records of the business to show that there's, you know, nothing is missing numeric, in order against their total sales. And it'll reconcile on the return. Does that help?
Madam Chair, I'll just make the point that I don't see how you can do a tracking mechanism to determine whether or not you've overtaxed or undertaxed an individual purchaser without knowing who the individual purchaser is. And that leads me to have a concern about whether or not we're going to inadvertently back into a registry.
Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, we're not actually going to be looking to see if a certain person paid the total amount. We're looking to make sure that the business remitted what it withheld based on its sales, what it collected on behalf of the user.
Senator Prezanski.
I hate to give Senator Farrelly bad news, but there's already businesses that are doing the sales that are actually tracking not only for the 24-hour period, but they're also able to say that that license that has come through that door has been used to purchase whatever quantity they bought over X number of days. I've seen it in a police report. So there are some that are actually tracking to that level. They're not clearing out after 24 hours like I thought we had been told that they were only going to use it to ensure on the recreational early sales there wouldn't be more than a quarter ounce sold in the 24-hour period from that dispensary.
And what do you suppose happened to all those background checks for firearm purchases?
Don't know what happened.
All right.
They're still in the computer.
So I know that we have two more panelists. Ms. Swift, are you also presenting, or are you here as a helpful resource just in case? Okay. So thank you for being here. I don't see any other question. Oh, we've got one more, and then we'll go to our
quick
final
one.
Panel.
You mentioned some people pay by money order. Does buying a money order from a bank, does that get around the banking issue?
No, it just expands the banking issue, Madam Co-Chair. They're buying it from grocery stores, from banks, from post office. They're buying it everywhere. It just is showing us how far-reaching this is in the economy. So it's not unique to this issue.
If I could follow up, would the banks be in trouble potentially? Because the reason the banks don't want to get into this business is they're afraid of getting in trouble with their regulators. Would a bank be putting themselves in jeopardy by selling a money order to someone who came in with cash money?
Madam Co-Chair, I really don't know the answer to that question. I'm not a banking law expert at all. We could probably have someone look into that and find out the answer to that.
Well, that would be worth looking into, because that's one option. If you can do it without jeopardizing anybody, it would be one option to improve employee safety and just security in
right.
general.
I would probably defer to our partners with the Treasury, who have the relationships with our banks, but we'll connect with them and get that question over there.
Thank you.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much for testifying today. And we will now call up our final panel, which is representatives of local jurisdictions, Rob Bovet with the Association of Oregon Counties and Scott Winkles with the League of Oregon Cities. Thank you both for being here and for your patience. The meeting goes until 2 p.m., just so you know. So you've got about 17 minutes, and maybe we can stay a minute or two over. I know a lot of us have 2 p.m. committees, though, so welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chairs, the members of the committee. For the record, Rob Bovet, Legal Counsel, Association of Oregon Counties. I'll be very brief. I just have some maps for you with pretty colors. I'm here to report on local options in terms of what the 36 counties have been doing with regard to opt-in, opt-out, time, place, and manner regulations, and local taxation. There are a whole laundry list of options. I'll just give you some raw numbers first. In terms of opt-in or out of marijuana businesses with election, 6 of 36 counties are looking at elections here in November.
Opt-in or opt-out?
That would be opt-out. Okay. Without an election, and that was the delimited time period for basically the eastern Oregon counties minus Wasco and Deschutes, opting out without an election. 12 of 36 counties chose that option. Interestingly enough, 3 that could have chosen that option did not choose that option. We'll talk about that in a minute. There's also opt back in. We've got one county, Deschutes County, that is going to opt back in and do time, place, and manner regulations. Thank you very much for your legislation earlier this year that enabled Deschutes County to do that. Through the initiative process, of course, in our Constitution, so far we've seen no initiatives to opt in or opt out. We have seen 2 referendums. For opt-out counties that had their ordinances placed on the ballot, and folks voted on those last week. I'll tell you about those election results in a moment. And of course, there's always the home rule option. So far, no counties have chosen a path other than a path that you have prescribed in Oregon law. All right, and reasonable time, place, and manner regulations. 12 counties have either adopted them or are in the process of adopting them. I think 10 are adopted and 2 are in process. In terms of local retail tax, with an election, of course, this November, at least 6 counties are going to have that ballot measure on in November, and I'll talk about which those are in a minute. So now the maps. Okay, so there's the yes and no results of Measure 91, which became relevant to the Eastern Oregon pejorative Helno counties, which is important because those will be the red counties in this map that could opt out without an election. And then the orange counties voted no, but would be required to have an opt-out election this November. So what are counties actually doing? That's how the map looks as of this morning. The counties in bright red are the Helno opt-out counties that aren't having an election. The dark red, Grant and Klamath, had referenda filed on their opt-out. I'll talk about the results of that here in a moment. And then you can see various other options. Most of Western Oregon is doing time, place, and manner regulations or just defaulting to the state regs, which are the 5 blue counties are just defaulting to the state regs. You can see most of the Western Oregon counties are doing time, place, and manner. There will be, 5 elections or 6 elections here coming up in November on opt-out, those being the orange counties plus Linn County, which has opted out of retail only since they previously allowed medical dispensaries. A couple of notes. So those are the 6 counties that are going to have a election on opt-out here later this year in November. Jackson County has had a LUBA appeal filed from their time, place, and manner ordinances. So far, the only appeal that I'm aware of from time, place, and manner regulations. Grant and Klamath counties, as I mentioned, had a referendum filed on their opt-out. They were both voted on by the people last week, and you can see the results. Both measures failed. So both of those 2 counties remain opt-out as of today. In terms of local option taxes, got counties all over the board here. The counties in green have told me they fully intend to have it on the ballot. The counties in blue are still undecided and processing the decision. They really have till August to make up their mind whether to put it on the ballot or not. Leaning towards putting on the ballot in yellow, leaning against in orange, I don't have any of those, and then not putting on the ballot in red. So Lake and Gillam and Jefferson are interesting in this sense. Those 3 counties, as I mentioned before, are hell no counties. They could have just opted out, but they put it on the ballot instead, so they chose a different path. And so I know that Jefferson, for example, a hell no county technically, will have both measures on the ballot this November in terms of opt-in or opt-out and local taxation, and Lake and Gillam are considering doing exactly the same. Last thing I'll just mention to you real quickly is a document that I created a couple of months ago that I know a lot of my fellow marijuana law practitioners have really appreciated, and I'll just mention it for everyone else. So as you know, Oregon Revised Statutes got published January of this year, and you did a lot of tinkering with the marijuana statute since then. We're not going to have another version of ORS come out till January of 2018. So what I did is I created a 139-page document. You could call it a marijuana code, essentially. I basically codified what you did, put it all into a document so you can see actually the current status of marijuana laws, which I find beneficial in my practice, and I know others have told me, so I'll just mention it. If you go to this particular web page that I've created on the AOC website, it's the top document there. And that's what I have for you. Happy to answer any questions, but I'll turn it over to my colleagues.
Wonderful. Thank you. Mr. Winkles, how are you?
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. I don't have a color-coded map for you. Rob's skills in that regard far outpace my own, but I would tell you that we have about 100 cities that have gone through the opt-out process or it is pending. The current list is on the OLCC website. In order for an opt-out to be, or moratorium to be in effect, the relevant agencies need to be notified. And so we've encouraged our pointed to our members, don't tell us, tell the agency. That's how the statute's designed to work. Our conversations within the League of Oregon Cities have shifted largely away from the bans and the moratorium and the opt-out to assisting the cities that are allowing, going to be participating in the regulated market and assisting them with implementation. I think the thing we've put the most amount of effort into thus far would be the intergovernmental agreement with the Department of Revenue. That draft was developed with in coordination with the Association of Oregon Counties, legal counsel with the League of Oregon Cities, and my tax and finance counterpart on the lobby team. That's been sent off to the agency. We've had numerous member inquiries in regards to that piece of it. As you all heard, the collection of this tax is logistically complicated, and so we've a number of smaller cities that are looking to go the IGA route for some administrative efficiency and for safety reasons. Also, the other thing we are working on is assisting cities that are choosing to refer a tax. I'm hesitant to say, give a projection of how many of my members right now are going to be referring a tax. I can tell you I get a lot of questions from the spectrum of my members, of the League of Oregon Cities membership, city attorneys, counselors, mayors, managers, finance directors, how many of those cities will go through it. I'm not sure. Cities are going through their budget process right now, and I think that's influencing that process. We are also working on some draft TPM ordinances. We are rolling those out. I believe the first week of June, this will be the third of three webinars that the League has put out designed to give cities information on the implementation issues. Some challenges that have been noticed among League of Oregon City members. One interesting scenario is we have a number of cities who are not banning, they're not opting out. They have no intention of fighting it. They've crafted TPM ordinances, or they've done something else to make their cities welcoming for the industry, but nobody's opened, hung out their shingle. So, for instance, the city of Donald is perfectly willing to allow a marijuana business. I'm not sure they're eager, but they're okay with it. And their perspective is, under the current financial distribution, even though they haven't prohibited, they're still not going to receive any of the shared revenue. They have some concerns over that. Additionally, some cities have voiced some concerns over the tracking requirement, the implicit tracking requirement in Measure 91 as to ensuring the money is used exclusively for marijuana expenditures. Trying to track what is, in relative terms, a very small amount of money through a general fund expenditure creates auditing problems, and there's a potential, we haven't seen it happen yet because nobody's done it, but a potential to see some audits come back problematic if we're not able to track each and every dollar. And I would point out that liquor revenue is somewhere in the neighborhood of $65 million for cities collectively, and that's not a requirement that's placed on those dollars. And so we're talking about a much smaller amount of money with potentially problematic tracking requirements. Additionally, we have had some reports from our cities, notably Portland, that we have some brick-and-mortar establishments that are selling but are not licensed by OHA. And sorry for the colloquial language, but the phrase we're using is it's a free-the-weed mentality, and where they're not looking to participate in a regulated market, but they would like the financial benefits of it. which happens in other industries, I will grant. But ensuring that there would be some civil enforcement ability in the statute that would deter this activity. I mean, theoretically, you could go through the process of building a robust criminal case, but I would note that in the OLCC, has civil enforcement authority for people who commit this activity on the liquor side, and mirroring or mimicking that statute with some minor adjustments would be helpful, that we would be able to go and place liens on properties and whatnot for people who are engaging in this activity to sort of emphasize the point that, no, really, we need people in the regulated market. That was the point of this exercise, and to have folks flaunting it is frustrating and problematic. And with that, I'm eager for your questions.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for our good colleagues from the local jurisdiction?
Just, Madam Chair,
yes, please.
This is just kind of looking for an anecdotal answer. Are you finding that the 3% local option tax is appealing to people and might actually make a difference in whether someone opts in or opts out? Or do you think if that were a little higher, it might provide more incentive?
Co-Chair Burdick, I don't know, but what I would say is that the projected revenue increase over the initial LRO estimate, it would probably help. You know, 18 million versus 6 is, that's simple math. So that may be an enticement for some cities.
Maybe we should cut the tax, Madam Chair.
Republican.
any follow-up? Do we have any other questions over on this side? Well, great. Thank you both so much for your testimony and for the hard work you've done helping us get to a reasonable place. I wanted to share that our next meeting of this committee is going to be sometime during the legislative days that will occur between the 21st and the 23rd of September, probably September 21st in the same 12 to 2 time slot, and we'll hear more about how implementation is going. In the meantime, feel free to talk to us about your needs and concerns. And with that, the informational hearing is closed and we're adjourned. With that, the informational hearing is closed and we're adjourned.